I've been treated as a king in your presence today. I appreciate all the good comments that you have made to me and the food that I was able to eat today, obviously. Thankful for being able to spend the day at the Blackaby's house. I appreciate that. Very nice and comfortable. Being able to sing and sing praises to God over there with the Hills and others. It's really great being with brethren. And that's really what this is all about every time we meet. being with God for eternity. I'm thankful for each and every one of you this evening who deemed it wise to meet your personal responsibility to come here with the other saints to uplift them, encourage them, rebuke even if necessary, but to fulfill your obligation to God as well. This sermon tonight is about dinosaurs. And it is probably the longest sermon I have. But be thankful, because you've got, as I tell the people back at home in Fairfax, you know, I believe that's one reason why they put these cushions on these pews, is so you can endure long sermons. Now, I'm not talking about a three-hour sermon, okay? That's the old days with Alexander Campbell and all those people. But this is a lengthy sermon for what I speak. And Bernie and Joan are saying, yeah, right, whatever. But I hope that you can enjoy this. I hope that it will perhaps help you with some of the things that you talked about. I talked with the brother this morning, and he said, you just don't realize, or we don't realize, how much evolution is really indoctrinated to our children. He was telling her that dinosaurs were created on the sixth day. She said, no, they're not. Or he said, no, they're not. They were. But you see, this is always infiltrating the minds of the youth in these schools and colleges and so forth. And so they make it so it seems as if it's just absurd to believe anything else. There is no other option. So everything I have tonight, I am greatly indebted to the work of Henry Morris and Dwayne Gish and others who work out in San Diego, California from the Institute of Creation Research. I am no doctor. Don't have any intention of being a doctor. But I love studying evidences. I love dinosaurs. I remember as a kid, the interest that I had in dinosaurs. My old man, or my dad, used to work and own a 3,000-acre ranch out in Nebraska, Wyoming, and South Dakota. The reason why he had so many acreage is because nobody wants to live out there. That's why land's cheap. But there are some people from Omaha, I believe, who came quite regularly. I perceive them to be some type of offshoot of paleontology or some sort. And they'd always go out there and find bones. And I had the privilege of seeing fossilized wood and fossilized turtles and bones like that. And other things like that. But I've always been interested. I'm sure that kids today, not just kids like this, but kids from all ages, after they watch movies like Jurassic Park, they probably ask their mom and dad, what about dinosaurs? What about dinosaurs? Where did they come from? And of course, some of the older ones are wondering, were they contemporaries with man or not? Many parents then have a hard time explaining this awesome subject to these younger people. And I believe there is absolutely no need to have any fear or trepidation with dealing with this great subject. Of course, I don't force this as a matter of doctrine. If you don't agree with everything I have to say, I don't care. I'm not going to hold you responsible. But I do think that we have a calling to see the truth on this subject. And as far as I can study, this is the truth. So accept it or not. This will not deal with every answer or every question about evolution and dinosaurs or what have you. I've got two full lessons on evolution. And this sermon here doesn't even touch it. What about dinosaurs? Well, first of all, there are some misconceptions about dinosaurs, three in general. Even these three are promoted by members of the church. I don't see how you can promote these three. The first one is, dinosaurs never existed. Some people believe that dinosaurs never existed. There is too much evidence. Absolutely too much evidence. There's not one bone. There are millions of bones, dinosaur bones, that you can see in museums. People didn't scheme this up to try to deceive people. They're real. They used to live and walk a domain upon this world, even as you and I do today. Others will say, God created the earth with dinosaur bones in it. They are members of the church who believe this. Absolutely absurd. Why would God create an earth of life? Something by which, friend, he speaks about in Genesis chapter 1, verse 31, as being very good. Why would he create a world, an earth, with dead bones inside of it? Is God the God or author of deceit? Absolutely not. Why would he deceive man like that? He wouldn't. Dinosaur bones are in the earth because they reveal to us a marvelous record. A record that will stand until this world is destroyed. And if I remember, I might talk a little bit about that later on. Others would say dinosaurs lived and are extinct before man was even here. This, of course, is the evolutionary position, and it's really taught as fact in most schools. They never really question or promote anything with creation. But it's, you know, if you're smart, you believe in evolution, and if you're dumb and ignorant like I am and many of you are, then you believe in creationism, you believe in the fable of the Bible. Well, that's an absurdity. Absolute absurdity. Unfortunately, there are Christians who even believe this doctrine of evolution. Many Christians are caught up in this very same thought. And there is absolutely no need to endorse evolution, friend. Think about it. Evolution states that from chaos came order. Is that what the Bible teaches? In the beginning there was chaos, and then order came? No, the Bible paints a picture of 100% structure. He paints the picture in Genesis chapter 2 of a garden. What is more structuralized than a garden? Not chaos. The Bible teaches structure came, organization came, and then chaos came. Evolution also teaches that the sexes evolved together, male and female. God said, the man was created and then the woman. And there are many examples I could give, tons of rebuttals, how you cannot endorse evolution and believe in the Bible. In fact, no animal died before man sinned. No animal died before man sinned. What am I saying? I'm saying because of sin, death came or originated in this world. If you'd open your Bibles to the book of Romans. In Romans chapter 5 and in verse 12, the Apostle Paul, speaking of death and sin here, said, therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin. And thus death spread to all men because all sinned. How did death get into the world, Paul? From sin. If that's not good enough for you, simply go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and in verse 21. The Apostle Paul said here, for since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. Paul, where did death come from? By man. Oh, I thought that it came from one organism overtaking another one. That's what I thought. I thought this T-Rex was destroying these other things to live. Is that where death came from? How can you believe these two awesome verses and believe that before man was here, death and life and struggle was going on? You can't believe that. You cannot endorse it. The scripture is evident, and it's clear on that matter. Well, one rebuttal would come then. If man lived with dinosaurs, how in the world could he exercise dominion over dinosaurs? How could man exercise dominion over a 5-ton or 10-ton or 150-ton dinosaur? Well, if you think there's any merit to this question, of course, God did state in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, when he said, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. every living thing. Exercise dominion over them. But keep reading. Keep reading. Verse 29. Notice the diet. Notice the diet of man and animal in this pristine world that God created. In verse 29, and God said, see, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food. Also to every beast. Also, as it is with man, so it is with every beast. Notice what he says. Every beast of the earth, would that include dinosaurs or not? Absolutely. And to every bird of the air, to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, I have given them every green herb for food, and it was so. If I believe the Bible, I believe that everything that was created in the beginning only had a vegetation diet. Tell me, a Tyrannosaurus Rex, vegetation diet? Yeah, right. Whatever. 6 foot or 6 inch teeth? 6 foot jaws? Vegetation diet? Well, why would the Tyrannosaurus Rex be any different than something smaller, of course? What about a lion? Lions love meat. Yeah, they were obviously created then as well, too. Can you picture a lion eating berries? Well, then I can picture a Tyrannosaurus if I believe the Bible to be true. And also, I might add, with this thing that was placed between carnivorous eating and just vegetation, think about the dominion would easily be exercised by man if he wouldn't have to worry about being eaten by a dinosaur. But also, notice with me that dominion was granted, but there is no evidence that dominion was ever regained by mankind. Turn with me, if you will, to the book of Psalms. In Psalm 8, verse 3, beginning, this man writes, I believe David, said, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? Where you have made him a little lower than the angels. He's talking about mankind here. And the Son of Man. And you have crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet. All sheep and oxen, even the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea that pass through the paths of the sea. Does that mean that dominion was granted or re-granted to man? Then you need to remember or jog your memory to the New Testament, the book of Hebrews. In the book of Hebrews chapter 2, this man, whoever the author is, was quoting from this very passage, verses 5 on, verse 6 on. But notice with me verse 8. He said, you have put all things in subjection under his feet. For in that he, or God, has put all things in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him. But now, we do not see all things put under him. We don't see all things put under mankind. The New King James, I don't know about your Bibles, but the New King James translators see this truth, and they do not capitalize that him there. Because he's regarding man, and that's why you see the contrast in the next verse. But, or in contrast to, we see Jesus. He was made a little lower than the angels. For the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that by the grace of God might taste death for everyone. You see, in the man Jesus Christ himself was a man who exercised dominion. He was a man who exercised dominion over food. He fed 5,000 people from 5 loaves of bread. He was a man that exercised dominion over the seas. He walked on it. He calmed the storm. He was a man who exercised dominion even over the fish. He told Peter to cast his nets on the right side, and the net was full. True dominion is in Christ. As the Hebrew writer said in verse 8, but we do not see all things because we don't have it yet. In fact, man is so subjected to the earth that we ultimately die and fall subject to the very ground that we walk on. Dominion is not regained. Oh, but it will be someday when we are in the likeness of Jesus Christ, when we resurrect from that grave. than dominion. We'll reign with Christ forever. That's a great feeling. That should motivate each and every one of us. But God never did reinstate dominion after the flood, after He destroyed man and the earth. Notice with me in the book of Genesis chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9, verse 1. So God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. But where's dominion? Continuing, and the fear of you and the dread of you. You see what he has replaced? There is no more like Adam who would have these animals go before him and he named them. There's no more like Noah where he would stand in the ark and the animals would come to him. Now God says, I am placing this between you and the animal kingdom. Fear and dread. When you go out in the woods at night, you see a coyote. Does the coyote run up to you and want to play ball? Absolutely not. You see a pack of wolves. Do they want to come and play frisbee with you? No, they'll tear you to pieces. They hate you. There's dread, there's fear placed within them. And so God at this time enters in something that's a favorite appetite of mine, meat. He said in verse 2, and fear and dread, and you shall be of you shall be on every bird of the or beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, on all that move on the earth, and all the fish of the sea, they are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs. You see, man's diet has changed. Why? Because God changed it. That's why. Simple as that. The diet changed in Genesis chapter 9. It was different in the first 8 chapters. Well, some people say, well, then if dinosaurs existed with man, why do we not see dinosaur in the Bible? How come I can't read dinosaur in the Bible? Well, the answer is simple. Dinosaur, or the term dinosaur, is younger than our Bibles. That's why. The term dinosaur began when a person in 1822 saw an iguanodon tooth, was astounded. What in the world is this? And they started finding some other bones, and by 1840, a man by the name of Sir Richard Owen issued the name dinosaur for a completely new order of species. And he came up with this word from looking at iguanodons and megalosauruses, and he said he took from the Greek dino, which means terrible, and saurus, which means lizard. In essence, all dinosaur means is terrible lizard. And so you can see why you don't see dinosaurs in the Bible, because it's a relatively new term. But yes, I do believe dinosaurs lived and walked with man, and we'll see if they are in the Bible here just shortly. But here, if you can see it, which many of you can't, but right here you have, this is the inverse and this is the regular, like a negative here, so you can see it a little bit better. Footprints. Footprints of something big. Especially if you can see that these little critters right here are people, and the footprints right there. A big dinosaur. A dinosaur footprint. Oh yes, it was assumed to be 200 million years old, which I obviously already have a difficult mind understanding 200 million years. But think about how a footprint with the process of erosion and all that could actually stay there for 200 million years. But I could believe 2,000 years a little bit easier than that. And not only that, in this riverbed, there are also human footprints with these dinosaur footprints. And it's not just this riverbed. That has been found throughout the world. Human footprints, dinosaur footprints. Why? Because they are contemporaries with man. I believe that. I believe you need to believe that as well. But are dinosaurs in the Bible? Well, no, dinosaur is not in the Bible, but the thing dinosaur is in the Bible. The creature of a dinosaur is in the Bible. When you think about the definition, a terrible lizard. First of all, the Bible talks about dragons. Stories of dragons come from all over the world, from ancient times and traditions of men. Dragons were subjects of statues. They were subjects of art. They were subjects of painting. You might recall Nebuchadnezzar in his gate on the Ishtar, at Ishtar. A dragon was carved in that, whose name was Cyrus. But the Bible has many references to these as well. If you turn your Bibles to the book of Deuteronomy, and we'll just look at a few of these real quick in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32, verse 33. The New King James translates this poorly. It says, "The wine is the poison of serpents," the New King James says. The King James says, "dragons, and the cruel venom of cobras." You might go to the book of Nehemiah, chapter 2, and in verse 13, where Nehemiah said, "And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well," or dragon's well. I believe the New American Standard says that. I know the New King James does. Dragon's well and the refuse gate. I'm continuing on there. Turn with me to Psalm 74. Psalm 74, verse 13. It reads, "You divided the sea by your strength. You broke the heads of the sea serpents." Again, the King James Version says dragons. The New American Standard Bible uses sea monsters. He says, "You broke the heads of sea monsters," or dragons, "in the water. You broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gave him as food to the people inhabiting the wilderness." This word that is used in all these verses is the Hebrew tannin, which is spelled T-A-N-N-I-Y-N. From that word, people translate these different things: sea serpents, sea monsters. It's the same word that's found in Genesis chapter 1, verse 21. The same exact word, and the King James Version translates it whales. The New American Standard translates it sea monsters, which is probably more accurate. Whales, great sea creatures, is really what it is. And really, that's what all these verses, it has the same word in all these verses that I'm giving you. Tannin. And it can mean a variety of creatures, either on land or on sea, depending on the context. Also notice with me Psalm 91. Psalm 91, verse 13. "You shall tread upon the lion and the cobra, the young lion and the serpent you shall trample underfoot," or dragon. When I think of serpent, I think of a sea snake. I think of a little water snake or something like that. I don't like that term, serpent. Dragon, you see, fits it better. Isaiah chapter 27 is another one, verse 1. It reads, "In that day the Lord, with his severe sword, great and strong, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent." Should be dragon. Leviathan, that twisted serpent. "And he will slay the reptile that is in the sea." Isaiah, one more. Isaiah 51, verse 9. Isaiah 51, verse 9. It reads, "Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the ancient of days, in the generations of old. Are you not the arm that cut Rahab apart and wounded the serpent," or dragon, or sea monster, whatever your version says? The King James, the New American Standard Version, and the New Revised Standard Version all use dragon in that instance. How would man know so much about these creatures if he was not a contemporary with them? The frequency of this, now here's a quote from Henry Morris, who does this stuff regularly. He said, "The frequent references to dragons in the Bible, as well as early records of traditions in most of the nations of antiquity, certainly cannot be shrugged off as mere fairy tales. Most probably they represent memories of dinosaurs handed down by tribal ancestors who encountered them before they became extinct. It would be hard for these stories to have such similarities if they never really ever once existed." Again, I'm using dragon generally here. Whether it's land or sea, ancient stories say some could fly, some could go in the sea and water, some could breathe fire. There's another term that's used in the Bible, which is definite a dinosaur, and that is Leviathan. We've already read about it in Isaiah 27, verse 1, and in Psalms. But Leviathan, one of my favorite creatures in the Bible. If you go to the book of Job, verse or chapter 41, I want to read this in your presence because I believe that it will drive it home more what you're reading. In Job chapter 41, verse 1, God says, he asks these hypothetical questions, or rhetorical questions rather. He says, can you draw out Leviathan with a hook, or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose, or pierce his jaw with a hook? By the way, the answer to all these questions is emphatically no. Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons, or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle? Never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is vain. Shall one not be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce. Here's the application so far to Job. No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine. God said, you see this creature that I've created, the Leviathan? We're going to keep reading here. You see how futile it is for you to even touch this thing? This thing would tear you up. And yet you think you can test me. God is the one that could destroy Leviathan. Continuing here in verse 12, he says, I will not conceal his limbs, his mighty power, or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with a double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face? Remember the Tyrannosaurus Rex? 6 foot jaws, 6 inch teeth. Doors of his face is what God describes this creature. And then he says, with his terrible teeth all around. You want the word terrible? There's terrible. And he's talking about his teeth. We've got a terrible lizard. We've got a dinosaur. His rows of scales are his pride, shut up tightly as with a seal. No one so near another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They stick together and cannot be parted. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot, and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. Strength dwells in his neck, and sorrow dances before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together. They are firm on him and cannot be moved. His heart is as hard as stone, even as hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. Because of his crashings, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, nor does spear, dart, or javelin. He regards iron as straw, and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones become like stubble to him. Darts are regarded as straw. He laughs at the threats of javelins. Laughs at it. His undersides are like sharp potsherds. He spreads pointed marks in the mire. Obviously, a rough stomach. Some people try to say, this is an alligator here. Mm-mm. You ever see the underside of an alligator? Not rough, not pointed, but smooth. This man here, or this thing here, is flat out awesome. Overwhelming. He makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. In verse 32, he leaves a shining wake behind him. One would think the deep had white hair. You ever see a ship go out? All that white stuff that comes from time. This is like what this creature does. On earth there is nothing like him. Verse 33. Which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. Whatever imaginable thing you can create in your mind to believe it to be a prideful creation, understand that this thing here was originated in the mind of God to teach people back then about real pride. He was a king of it. You see, wherever this creature went, he had absolutely no fear. In fact, arrogance would float about him. He couldn't care less whether you had any type of weaponry. He could care less about anything else. He was always 100% victorious. And we think this picture is scary. Imagine God on Judgment Day. But think about the defense mechanism of this creature. First of all, God is careful to describe to us his outer coat. In verse 13, it says, who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with the double bridle? You can't remove his outer coat. Verses 15 through 17. His rows of scales are his pride, shut up tightly. This is an airtight configuration here. You can also read verses 26 through 30 if you want on your own time. Again, for emphasis. But notice his size, verse 25. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. Because of his crashings, they are beside themselves. Does an alligator raise itself up? Does an alligator make crashings? Absolutely not. This thing here, when you see him raise up, is overwhelming to your eyes. If this isn't a dinosaur, we don't know what dinosaurs were. So, you've got his outer coat and his size. You've got his teeth, as we already talked about in verse 14. His face, talked about as doors. And his teeth talked about as being terrible. You've got, number four, his breath. Notice verses 18 through 21. You think your breath is bad in the morning. This creature here would blow you away with fire. Notice with me again, just for emphasis here, about this thing's breath. In verse 18, it says, his sneezings flash forth lightning, and his eyes are like the eyelids of morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils and from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals and a flame goes out of his mouth. Sparks of fire, smoke, flames. Oh, wait a second. Now you just made me lose faith completely. I don't believe that anything could blow fire out of his mouth. I can't believe that, preacher, and then you cannot believe the resurrection of a dead man either. You cannot do it. If you can't believe this, you can't believe that Jesus died and that he was buried and that he was resurrected again. But you do. But I don't want to be too hard on you. There is, I'll give you some more evidence to believe this. And again, most of you won't be able to see this, but you can at least listen. There's a particular beetle called the bombardier beetle that is talked about at great length in many books that I could recommend to you if you're interested. And this beetle has an awesome defense mechanism. Inside of him, he's got two little chambers where he has this certain type of fluid, hydrogen peroxide or something like that. And then he's got this combustion chamber where these two things meet. And guess what this little half-inch long beetle does when an enemy approaches him? He fries them at 212 degrees. A half-inch beetle. Present-day example. So then Henry Morris and others looked at the skulls of some dinosaurs and they said, well, this has tracks throughout this skull, and it seems quite feasible that fluid and fluid could mix and come from his mouth and blow out fire. If a beetle, a half-inch beetle, can produce 212-degree temperature working over ants, toads, birds, imagine what a 5-ton dinosaur could do. Imagine that, a 5-ton dinosaur having this type of mechanism. No wonder God said when he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. Not only that, there is one other thing that's talked in the Bible that I believe, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that is in fact a terrible lizard. One of those dirty old dinosaurs. The behemoth. The behemoth is talked about in the chapter preceding Job 41. In Job chapter 40, begin with me if you will, in verse 15. God says, "Look now at the behemoth which I made along with you." What, God? I made, underscore that, I made along with you. Whatever this creature is, it was a creature that was made with God, or with man. God created him and all these other things on the sixth day, the same day he created man. Continuing, he eats grass like an ox. Therefore, you can rule out an ox because he eats like it. See, now his strength is in his hips, and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. Many liberal theologians say this is talking about a hippopotamus or an elephant. Rule it out. Rule it out. Show me a hippopotamus or an elephant with a tail that is moved like a cedar. That's a twig. It's a little twig that those things have. God says, look at this creature's tail. It's like a cedar. His bones are like beams of bronze. God's not exaggerating. He's simply telling it like it is. His ribs are like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. Again, like the Leviathan, only the person that created him, God himself, can destroy this creature. Man can't. He's too massive. He's too massive. Surely the mountains yield food for him. Why? Because he's got a massive mountainous appetite. That's why. And all the beasts of the field play there. He's not one of these terrible looking things. He's just there. He doesn't much care about anything. As long as he has his food, he's happy. And it's not even the other creatures. He lies under the lotus trees in a covert of reeds and marsh. The lotus trees cover him with their shade. The willows by the brook surrounded him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he is not disturbed. He is confident, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth. This creature lived in Palestine. If you've ever gone to the Bible lands, you have probably walked right where this creature that God was talking about walked. In fact, right here where we are presently, there were probably dinosaurs roaming right here through this building. Not millions of years ago, but perhaps thousands of years ago. Continuing, he says, though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierce his nose with a snare, he just doesn't care. It doesn't matter if it's flood season and the River Jordan is just flowing right in his face. He doesn't care because it's not going to move in. He doesn't even care if somebody takes a spear and punches it in his nose. It's not a threat. You can obviously see that this creature is something more than a hippopotamus, more than an elephant, something, in fact, that we call dinosaurs. Well, with all of this in mind, were dinosaurs on the ark? If I believe that dinosaurs were in the beginning, with man, created on the sixth day. Were dinosaurs in the Ark of Noah? Very good question. Were they? Well, the answer is yes and no. You can read that. Yes and no. The reason why I say yes is because they had to be dinosaurs that lived on the earth and breathed through lungs like this air like you and I do. If you go back to the book of Genesis again, the foundational book of the entire Bible, Genesis chapter 6, and in verse 19, notice here the destructive force, or the subjects of this destruction. Of every living thing, of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Every living thing of all flesh. Other places he talks about, like chapter 7, verse 15, We know there that all flesh of every living thing was to be taken in the ark. But then he modifies it in chapter 7. Notice verse 15. And they went into the ark to Noah, two by two, of all flesh in which is the breath of life. See the modification? It needed to have the breath of life. Skip over to verse 21 and 22, and he defines this a little bit more. He says, and the flesh, and all flesh died that moved on the earth. Where did it move? On the earth. Birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of the life, all that was on the dry land died. You see, Noah didn't have to worry about taking fish or anything else that lived in the sea. He didn't have to worry about that. The only thing he was worried about or was concerned about were those things that had the spirit of the breath of life, the ability to breathe in this air as you and I do. The flood wasn't going to destroy those other creatures, per se. Not ultimately, not make them extinct. And so, yes, I believe dinosaurs were on the ark. Well then, if I say that, I get bunches of objections. Objections of all sorts of things. First of all, people will say, what about the gatherings of these animals? How is Noah supposed to go out and round up a bunch of dinosaurs and take them into the ark? How was Noah supposed to go out and round up a bunch of tigers and take them in the ark? He wasn't. He didn't have to round up anything and take it into the ark. Notice the language of Genesis chapter 6, verse 19. Yeah, Genesis 6, verse 19. He said, of every living thing, of all flesh that shall that you shall bring, take two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive, and you, with you. They shall be male and female. Skip on up to verse 15 of chapter, see if I can find it here. I'm sorry, verse 20. You got that? Verse 20. Of the birds after their kind, of animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. What did God say? Two of every kind will come to you. You don't go out and round them up. They're going to come to you, Noah. And so once they come to you, take them into the ark two by two. God's miraculous hand was in this. God wouldn't ask Noah to do something that is ultimately impossible. So then other objections come up. What about the storage of these animals? How could there be enough room on the ark to store dinosaurs? How could there be enough room on the ark to store all these creatures, including dinosaurs? Well, first of all, it would seem like God would send the young version of a dinosaur rather than the old 150-pound mother and father, or 150-ton mother and father. But also we believe, if we think that there's any merit in this, we really forget how huge the ark was. You know, the dimensions are given in chapter 6, verse 15, that it was 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. The average cubit, of course, today or back then was about 17.5 inches. That was the smaller of the two. And then there was a larger one given, which was 24 inches. That was 2 feet. John C. Whitcomb looks at these figures, and through his scientific stuff, he wrote this. He said, for the sake of realism, imagine waiting at a railroad crossing while 10 freight trains, each pulling 52 boxcars, move slowly by one after another. That is how much space was available in the ark, for its capacity was equivalent to 520 modern-day railroad cars. 520. There was ample room on the ark, particularly if you took the younger version. What about the care for these animals? Others will say, how in the world did 8 people, Noah, his wife, his 3 sons, and their wives, how could they take care of all these animals? Again, if you think there's any credibility in this argument, you have forgot about God. You've left him out of the picture. In chapter 7 of Genesis, verse 1. What do you see in chapter 7, verse 1? When it reads, then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Does it sound like God is saying, Noah, I'm going to punish you with this dirty job of keeping up these animals? What do you see in chapter 7, verse 1? You see an invitation by God. Come into the ark. Kind of like Jesus said, come to me, all you who are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Was God going to torture Noah for his righteousness? That's absurd to think that. We forget God is in the picture. He was in the ark with Noah. Talking about God, we're talking about God who put peace between Daniel and the mouth of the lions when he was unjustly thrown in the cage. We're talking about God, God the Son, who in Mark chapter 6, verse 32 through verse 44, fed 5,000 people with 5 loaves of bread. Why could he not feed those animals like he did the people? Why could he not work a miraculous event? If you strip it away from that, you're stripping God out of the Bible. These are not problems. They just need to have answers. And the answer is here. If God could do it with 5,000 people, he could certainly do it with an ark full of animals. In fact, it kind of hints around at, in chapter 8, that the reproductive cycle for animals was put on hold while they were in the ark. In Genesis chapter 8, verse 17, it reads, bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. When did God tell these creatures to multiply? After the ark. Why couldn't he form some type of hibernation? We have bears who do it today. Why couldn't God miraculously do it then on the ark? Kind of give them a doze of sleep for about a year. Why could he not do it? You're limiting the power of God. I shouldn't have to give you a natural explanation for every argument that rises. We're talking about God here. If you can't believe Genesis chapter 1 and in verse 1 and 2, you can't believe any part of the entire Bible. It was God who created heaven and earth. It was God who created the seas. It was God who created all that we see, all that we walk on, all that we use. Why could he not know how to deal with this creation of animal kind? He did. He took care of them. He was there in the ark. And I believe there are scriptural evidence to support that. Which is why Noah and his 8 people wouldn't have to spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, cleaning up after a whole herd of artful animals. God was there. Don't ever forget it. Come to me in the ark. Come to me in the ark. Well, then the question comes, what happened to dinosaurs? What happened to dinosaurs? The question of the century, especially after Jurassic Park. What happened to dinosaurs? Let me tell you, friends, those of you who are in school, those of you that are in younger grades, those of you that are in college, wherever you are in life, let me tell you this, that nobody really knows what happened to the dinosaurs. Not the evolutionists, not anybody. Now, there are many hypotheses given, of course. One that I'm sure many of you are familiar with is that there were too many predators, and so these dinosaurs, their eggs got all eaten up, and they couldn't reproduce fast enough, so they just kind of died out, fizzled out. Why did not the turtles and the snakes and the crocodiles die out as well? Others will give the answer that dinosaurs just had too small brains to survive and compete with their competitors. What difference does it make? If I weigh 10 tons, do you think it matters how big my brain is? Am I going to be scared of anything? Can I not survive? I don't care if my brain was the size of a quarter. I wouldn't have to worry about it. It would pose no threat to me whatsoever. The last thing I would be worried about is if a cow's going to overtake me, or a person, or anything else. It just doesn't matter. It's an absurdity to even suggest that their brains were a problem for their survival. God didn't make any junk. That goes for animals, and that goes for you. He didn't make junk. He made us to survive. Recently, though, you may have been familiar with this third one, and that is many advocates are saying that there was a massive, huge asteroid, and it collided into the Earth, and when it collided into the Earth, there were 3 billion tons of dust that went up into the sky. Why 3 billion? I don't know. They like billion, okay? You can tell that from the aging process. But it was 3 billion tons of dust that went up into the air, blocking out all sunlight, and so there really wasn't enough food for these dinosaurs to live. And so they just kind of killed over. Well, again, why did the other creatures survive, like the snakes and the crocodiles and so forth? Why did they survive and the dinosaurs not? You know what is so funny about this? Because it's so widely advocated among so many evolutionists, and they're real serious about this. Kind of pass me a plate of foolishness, and we'll talk about dinosaurs. What's really funny about this is that instead of accepting a catastrophe that God so vividly describes in Genesis chapter 6 and 7, they have to formulate a catastrophe to combat what was already known. They have to come up with their own wisdom and say, yeah, it must have been an asteroid that came into the earth and destroyed it, or almost virtually destroyed all life. But I tell you what, that's a sign, my friends. That's a sign that the creationist is winning, that people aren't buying the evolutionary trash that they infiltrate in the minds of the youth. They're not buying it because it's foolishness. Why would I think that I came from an ant, or that ants and I are related, or birds and I are related, or my cow or my dog, in some distant way, I'm a relative to them? You know better than that. I can't think of anything more foolish. It is the most wild concoction of human wisdom that I have ever studied. Is the theory of evolution. And people are not buying it. And so these evolutionists, these people that are so involved in this pottage of foolishness, have to come up with another type of destruction. And so they're leaning more towards cataclysm. They're leaning more towards catastrophe. Why? Because it was already planted in the back of their minds from all these creationists saying, the world was destroyed, the world was destroyed, the world was destroyed. Maybe it was destroyed. But we know it wasn't destroyed by water. That's absolutely not possible. And so we come up with the theory, the asteroid theory. Sad thing, but I think it shows that we are winning. My personal, for what it's worth, you can kick it out the door or whatever you want. My personal belief is this. That dinosaurs, the massive amount of them, were destroyed in the flood. I believe that they were taken on the ark. And I have shown you with consistency how that can be. I believe that they came out of the ark. And there was enmity between them and man, like anything else. But God had his providential care over man. But I believe that the world which once existed, and I've got a whole sermon on this too, the world that once existed perished. It was changed. It was destroyed. There is biblical evidence for you and I to study this out, to see that the world that once existed was a different world than the world we live in today. I'm not going to get into all that, but think with me on these things. We know that dinosaurs lived in Alaska. They lived in the Arctic Circle. They lived in Antarctica. They lived in desert places of today, like Utah and China. How could a dinosaur live in Antarctica? How could a dinosaur have enough vegetation in a desert when we don't even have enough vegetation in a desert? I'll tell you why. Because the world which once existed was not a world that was scarred by deserts or iced over polar regions. It was not scarred with these things. These things came about when God set up a new order in the world that we live in today. You go to the Arctic Circle, you'll be surprised and happy to find a half-inch thorn bush growing. You know what they found in the Arctic Circle? Frozen, a 90-foot plum tree with fruit on it. Now, how can a 90-foot plum tree grow in the Arctic Circle? Because at one time it wasn't Arctic. That's why. It wasn't frozen. And yet you can find millions of remains of mammoths there. Some mammoths with the flesh on them that you can take out, cook, and eat. How could a mammoth survive in the Arctic Circle? Because the Arctic Circle wasn't always frozen. That's why. It was, in fact, a tropical paradise, uniform region. The worldwide had pretty much the same climate throughout all the world, and there is so much scientific proof to prove it, and yet very few of these evolutionists, when they're slapped right in the face, will not believe it. Sad, but true. See, evolutionists are not equipped to thinking catastrophic, even though they're moving that direction. They're used to thinking uniformitistically. In other words, as Peter said in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 4, that some would come then and say that as our fathers were, all things continued. I'm not quoting this by any means. All things continued as they were from the creation. Okay, he's talking about false teachers there. And that's exactly what the evolution is. They believe that all things continued at the same uniform rate since creation, which they wouldn't even use creation. Okay, since the Big Bang or whatever they want to use. But we're winning. And we need to keep faith for that. Dinosaurs did not live and die millions of years before man. They were created with man. That's the first conclusion I want you to bring about into your minds this evening. Secondly, they were contemporaries with man. The Bible talks about them. Third, they were in the ark. They were in the ark with Noah. And I believe they are still living today. What do you mean, preacher man? Yeah. You heard me say it. And I don't apologize for it either. I don't apologize for anything that I've said tonight or this morning. When you look at the definition, a terrible lizard, you see terrible lizards living today on the island of Komodo. About 1,000 Komodo dragons. And they are terrible, ugly creatures, and they still live today. Not to mention the 20-foot alligators that used to roam this world. Is that not a terrible lizard? 20 feet, imagine how long 20 feet is. That's how long some of these alligators were. Here's a graphic for you. Any of you can see that? Guess when this was discovered? 20 billion years ago, this thing was discovered in 1977 when Japanese fishermen were on the boat Zuyo Maru. Excuse me there if you know Japanese. They were fishing off the coast of New Zealand in about 900 feet deep water. I've done deep sea fishing in 300 feet. I couldn't imagine 900 feet. But you know what? That's shallow. For some parts of the world. Some parts of the world are over 28,000 feet deep. Amazing. And we think we know every creature that's living. This thing here, 1977. 32 feet long. Weighed over 4,000 pounds. Got tangled up in their net. Fisherman's worst nightmare. One of my favorites. They drug it up. They expected or believed it to be dead for about a month. And guess what? How long do these things live, do you think? Do they live thousands of years? No. They have a normal lifespan like anybody else or anything else. So if there's one, chances are he's not the last of the dying breed. There's probably others. And this is just one kind. There are other stories, so many other stories. The megamouth shark. A mouth like this, it's just incredibly ugly. They found it. They didn't know what it was. Some of these things that these evolutionists thought were extinct, they found out that people in Africa have been fishing for them for years. And yet they're supposed to be extinct 2 million years ago, or 200 million years ago. I hope this lesson has benefited you. I don't claim it to answer all the questions, but I do hope it sets a foundation. Take the Bible and what it says. Believe it. Just believe it. If I can believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, if I can believe that God created the heavens and the earth, if I can believe that Jesus Christ resurrected from the dead, I can believe in dinosaurs. And guess what? So can you. So can you. Believe the Bible. Believe God's Word. This wasn't really directed at, per se, it wasn't directed at really non-Christians. It was really more Christians, more people who wanted defense for themselves. And I barely touched the hem of the garment, friends. We need to have more preaching on evidences. Many of the younger people are being brought up without this knowledge. And so I give a wholehearted amen to anybody who's willing to take the time to study it. But you know what? We talked about a fossil record in the beginning of this sermon. People who say that God planted the fossils there, in a sense, deceptively, to see what we would do, you really missed the point why the fossil record is there. You see, the fossil record is underneath the ground, serves as simply that, a record. It is projecting out truth. It's how we interpret that truth. Just like this is a record. We've got to interpret this the right way or we will have false doctrine. God gave us the fossil record to tell us that there was once a world that existed. And because of something that is labeled as S-I-N, sin, the world was destroyed. All those thousands and millions of remains that are under the ground serve as a record, a testimony that this world was filled with sin and God destroyed it. And that gives us a prototype of what's coming. Oh, God's not going to destroy it like He did the first time, in that it will still exist afterwards. He's not going to just destroy the way it functions. He's going to ultimately consume this heaven and this earth. Why? Because of sin. And the righteous are looking for new heaven and new earth. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 13. Guess how you become righteous? By subjecting